Welcome to the Over My Dead Body podcast, episode 24. I'm your host, Alex Lidington Cox, a former journalist and foreign correspondent. With News Limited and Schwartz Media. Today we'll be speaking with my buddy, a fellow Alex, Alex Breeden. He's got three kids. Count them. Three. What a freak. Like, who has three kids? Seriously, who has three kids nowadays? Australia's fertility rate has sat below two children per couple more or less since the early 1990s. And if you talk to young families nowadays, they're pretty definitive. Two kids, no more. We'll chat to Alex about three. We'll also be getting into Parch March. Alex and I both gave up booze for the month. This is the second time we've done it together. So we'll be reflecting on the results as well as the impact on our parenting and general well-being. Plus, we'll be talking about my rectal health. There's a lot to get into. But first, I give you the Oaks.
You don't have like a laugh track.
No. And I've desperately needed one a few times when I'm telling jokes into the ether and I have no idea if they're gonna land. I'm just like, oh, that's funny.
Yeah. No, I've loved the Simpsons splices that you had in the recent podcast.
Yeah,
just like, how many Simpson references can I get in as possible?
I can definitely get in more. I can definitely cram in more than that. But yeah, they have definitely acted as a laugh track of sorts.
You were saying.
So
flexibility.
Yeah, but I do really feel like I would not want to be a young person in today's workplace where you go into the office and there's nobody there to learn from.
Yeah, I remember when I was starting and I was a bit of a maniac, you know. I would do late nights and work really hard and I loved being in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
We never called it an office.
Right.
Yeah, it's not an office, it's a studio. And it was a studio in the sense that it's creative, that we're drawing and working together on, you know, creating these. I'm a landscape architect, by the way, for context. Creating parks and gardens, and I loved it. I loved being in. I worked in a variety of places and in a couple of studios, and yeah, the ones that I loved the most were the ones where my bosses were there and I was working directly with them, and I was just sponging everything, you know. And I just didn't have a conception of, oh, this is 9 till 5. And it's like, I'm not glorifying it in any way, but it was probably partially a sign of the times. And now I see, you know, it might be the studio that I'm in at the moment a bit, which is culturally different, but I do think that Australia has changed dramatically. Like, I remember when I started my career in Melbourne, the culture was a lot more like that. Like, I was fitting into the culture. But now I see the younger people in my office, especially the younger people that had essentially almost just finished school when COVID came in. And they're all about balance and, you know, not working super late and, you know, trying to get out on time and have a life. I think they're very conscientious that they've lost 3 years of their life and they're trying to grab it back.
Yeah.
So there's this sort of tension between them wanting to be in the office and, you know, be sponges because it's the start of their career, and then the opposite going, like, you know, just a healthy anti-corporate mentality.
Yeah.
Like, why am I giving my time to the man? You know? And it's like, yeah. I don't think anybody's found that perfect balance of like, okay, I need experience in my discipline, but I don't want to sell myself.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
For the listeners, you have three children now.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you said to me recently is you'd read a book that was basically making the case of decide how many children you want and then have one more.
Yeah.
Discuss.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of regret mentioning this book that I've read now. It's called Selfish Reasons to Have More Children. Mm. I've forgotten the author's name. Maybe you can look it up. And it actually wasn't a very well-written book, but there were some key takeaways from it. So, you know, when you and our friends were repressing me on this book, you were going, yeah, but what's the logic? And I was like, I don't think he really had a logic. I think he just liked kids.
Yeah.
You know. So he has four kids. Mm. And the premise of the book is essentially kids are a lot less work than what people think they actually are. Mm. And then another key premise of the book is that statistically, once people have children, they very, very rarely regret it. You know, it's something like it's in the single digits. It's like 2 or 3% of people regret having children.
Yeah.
So he was saying statistically, if you have a kid, you're probably not going to regret it. And then secondly, here are all of these reasons why kids aren't actually that much work.
Mm.
So therefore, you should have one more kid than you think that you actually should, that you think you want.
Yeah.
So if you have no kids, you really should have one kid.
And I think that part of the reason why this conversation did not gain traction with the audience that you had at the time is that everybody has young children.
Yes.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the point of the book is that kids are an awful lot of work in the early years, mm. and then it really tapers off.
Yeah. Yeah, that was another point he was making, which I think we're yet to see that.
I have no idea what this guy is talking about.
Exactly. Yeah. We're like, yeah, can't really see the forest from the trees yet. Yeah, but supposedly, yeah, we need to ask our older mates that, yeah, it tapers off relatively quickly, like supposedly from 6 on,
mm.
you know, Hazel's what, 4?
Yep.
So, you know, there's, yeah. He once again was saying it was like it's over before you know it. Like, for example, I left for work early this morning, and I left at about 6 o'clock in the morning, and then Ellery had woken up,
mm.
And you know, she saw that I was going. Usually, if she saw that I was going, she would have absolutely lost it. Mm. You know, she would have. I couldn't leave. This morning, I left the light on. I went, you know, made my lunch, you know, went to the bathroom, came back, she was asleep, you know, and then I snuck out.
Mm.
So it's little things like that I've started to see
mm.
that are tapering off, and you know, like then we're gonna regret it. We're gonna miss it.
Mm.
You know, it's like, oh, remember when they like actually wanted to hang out with us?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I know that a lot of people, for understandable reasons, think that Jordan Peterson is a 100% fraught figure, but I find that there is quite a lot that he says that does resonate. A lot mm. of it doesn't have to do with gender.
Mm.
A lot of it's to do with just his expertise as a psychologist or a psychiatrist or whatever.
Mm.
And he had this one observation about having kids. He said,
when you have a baby, say, it's, you can't believe it. And you can't believe that you're going to be able to figure out what to do with this thing. Like, it's the most complicated thing you've ever had, and no one has helped you figure out how to do it. So you're stuck. And then like 3 months later, it's like, you can't really imagine what life would be like without that baby. And then it's sort of like, this goes on forever. That's how it feels, but it doesn't.
Right.
You have little kids for 4 years. And if you miss it, it's done. That's it. So you got to know that. It's, you know, lots of things in life you don't get to do more than once. Now, obviously, you can have more than one child, but all I'm saying is that period between 0 and 4, 0 and 5, there's something about it that's really, it's like a peak experience in life. And it isn't much of your life. you know, because you think of it as a long time. It's not that long, man. 4 years goes by so fast you can't believe it. And if you miss it, it's gone. So you miss it at your peril and you don't get it back. And that's not, I know it with your career, you miss opportunities, you fall behind. This happens to women a lot. It's part of the reason for the pay gap. And it's really hard on women. And I would also say, well, you talk to each other, try to minimize your financial requirements to the degree that you can. See if there's other ways that you can generate income. But, and do your, come to a consensual solution and try not to torture yourself with guilt with whatever you come up with. But do remember, because you know, you've got financial responsibilities and often you need two incomes and there's no easy way of dealing with it. And for women, it often seems that no matter what they do, it's wrong, right? They stay home with the kids, it's wrong. If they go to work, it's wrong. If they do both, it's wrong. And I'm not being smart about that. Mm-hmm. That's rough, man. Mm-hmm. But having said all that, I would say again, you got little kids for 4 years. Don't miss it. You will regret it.
Granted, he was basically using that as an argument to prosecute traditional gender roles. but the substance of it was spend as much time as you can with your kids before they're five.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was also part of an argument where he was saying that guys need to pull themselves out of the workplace as much as possible before they're 5 years old. Because after that, they're just not yours anymore in a basic way.
Do you think you're doing that? Do you think you're spending enough time at home?
So I'm a little bit, I have an advantage in the fact that I run my own business. Now, for the audience at home, I am a chief executive of one person because it's just me. It's just a sole trader. So if I fire somebody, it's a bad day. but that does provide me with a lot of flexibility. I only work 4 days. So we have both of the kids home on Friday. The trade-off is the anxiety of where your next paycheck is coming from.
Yep.
And that ebbs and flows. Sometimes it ebbs and flows within the course of a week. And I would be lying if I said that that does not sometimes impact on my ability to be a parent when I'm with them because I'll be worrying about money. This week has been a nightmare. The start of the week was really anxiety-inducing. And then there was like I was optimistic come Tuesday and then on Wednesday it had dived again.
Oh my God.
And I was just like, oh my God, this is just such a roller coaster. And the whole time I'm trying to manage my energy levels.
Yeah, totally.
So, you know, I would be lying if I was, you know, I don't want to sell everyone on the dream of running your own business while having children because it is really, really difficult. But at the end of the day, I don't have to ask anyone permission to do anything with my kids. So yeah, like on Monday, one of them was sick. Rachel has no flexibility in her days on Monday and Wednesday. Kid was sick on Monday, needed a doctor's appointment on Wednesday.
Yeah.
And so I'm the only person that can do any of that. So I effectively lost a day and a half.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're working for a company, even if they have policies in place that say that's okay, there is so frequently a tone and an understanding that if you keep racking this up, you know, you will not be as valued a member of our employee base over time.
Yeah, totally. It's not a right.
Yeah.
And I think the podcasts that you did on parental leave were great. Really sort of uncovering that, you know, that this is a company policy, but it's been this sort of like gold rush of parental leave over the past couple of years and everybody's gotten giddy over the fact that, oh my God, companies are giving us parental leave. It's the most amazing thing ever. It's revolutionary. Mm-hmm. Look how progressive we are. And it's like, not that progressive, is it?
Yeah.
You know, it's just something that'll evaporate in the next crisis that we have, you know? Yeah. So very conscientious about it. Yeah. And that you just have to, everybody needs to read up about what rights they've actually got.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not that much, you know, back to parental leave. It's only 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, yeah, I think especially white collared workers, you know, that are employees on a salary, not getting lulled into. That sounds too antagonistic, but you know, it is a cultural thing that is only happening in white collared office working environments, you know, and it's like, let's not get too ahead of ourselves.
Absolutely. Okay? You talk to any company that works in a male-dominated industry, and they will always have much more qualified views about how much paternity leave should be available as opposed to maternity leave. So the examples that I'll list off that are immediately become apparent, I consult a lot in the energy industry, which is full of male engineers.
Mm.
And they will always say quietly, we can't afford equal parental leave because we have too many men on the books. So if we have a policy in place that favors women, that's great because we don't have many women. I used to work in a tech company which had a female head of HR who was in charge of all of these policies. And I said, we're competing against the Canvas, the Atlassians of the world that have really progressive parental leave policies in place. Mm. We need to at least match them or explain to them how we're going to match them in order to attract staff. And it was like talking to a woman in the 1990s. She was just like, I'm a bit old fashioned when it comes to parental leave. I think it's predominantly for the mum. You know, she needs time to recover and the dad will get his moment. That is I've got an email somewhere where that's what was said to me. And I was just like, good Lord.
Oh God.
And the final, another problematic industry, and their industries all over the place that are difficult. But construction has some of the lowest dad leave levels out there. And I remember thinking, like, who is the policymaker or influencer that's going to be chiefly responsible for increasing dad leave take up in the construction industry? And then we went, it's going to be John Setka.
As you point out, that Anthony Albanese has been trying to remove him from the party, and not just because of the Rosie Batty comments. Here's what Mr. Albanese had to say just before question time this afternoon.
I thought over a long period of time, through his actions, he demonstrated values that were not consistent with the values which the Australian Labor Party holds dear. One of those values is respect for women. The fact that he's been convicted of breaching a family violence order, and the fact that he was also convicted and pleaded guilty to harassment indicates that that's the case.
So for anyone listening outside of Victoria or outside of Australia, John Setka is the head of the CFMMEU, which is basically the blue-collar construction union. And I'm not saying I'm against unionism, but he has quite a rap sheet of domestic abuse and hitting his partner.
Yeah.
And this is the guy that we're supposed to be looking towards for pulling dads out of a very, very blokey industry and getting them into the home to change nappies. It's just Lord. And that's, to me, like, that's a lot of the landscape. It's a lot of corporate interests and blokiness butting up against this new dynamic that fits much better in a white collar environment.
Totally. But even within our, you know, white collar group of friends, they're not all white collar, but a lot of them are. There's even hesitancy there. Absolutely. You know, like I'm thinking of friends that we have that have got parental leave lined up or have recently had it. And they're not particularly enthused about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're like, well, you know, it's like kind of like being at work.
Yeah. 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 It's not a holiday. And
yeah, exactly. Or at least when you do the first one, you realize how hard it is. Yeah.
Or you and I were having a chat with another friend of ours who had some work leave coming up. And let's say that there was a change in ownership structure associated with his job.
Mm.
And the tone of the room was universal. Do not mention that your partner's pregnant until you are absolutely sure it's not going to seriously impact your role.
Oh, totally.
And that's something that guys are so sensitive to.
Mm. Well, me and this person were going through it at the same time. So I told my employer 2 months before the birth, like it's 7 months or something like that.
Yeah.
You know? Because of you, Coxie.
Yeah, I know.
Because you scared the absolute shit out of me. You and Dave. So I left it to the absolute last minute.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I cooked it a little
bit. yeah, exactly. Well, I'm still sitting on a bunch of leave, so I really need to start taking it. So, yeah.
Back to your three kids and this and this book. The author's name is Brian Kaplan.
That's it.
Yeah. And I think if I could summarize the reaction of most young parents, it's just, yes, that's all well and good, but there's a disproportionate, as you and I were discussing on the day, there's a disproportionate impact on the mother of having an extra kid. It doesn't matter how many it is.
Yeah.
So how do you manage that as a couple? If you've accepted this idea of, hey, let's have one more, how do you manage that?
Going into the third one, it was finances were a huge part of the consideration. You know, when we were doing number one and number two, it was like, yeah, whatever, you know, especially number one, it just didn't really factor into it financially. I take that back. I was extremely anxious about finances before I actually did the calculations on how much one kid would cost, and then I did it and it made no difference. But I have worked mostly full time, and then I've did a big chunk of part time around number two. Kaz, my wife, has gone in and out of no work to part time to full time. So she did get up to 4 days a week for a bit. So Kaz, she has bore the brunt of most of the change in employment. And that's understandable. So, by the time it got to the third one, it was like, yeah, we were really looking at the books and going like, you know, do we want to essentially go back financially for, you know, a year or so, and is it going to be worth it, you know? And we decided that, yeah, we were going to do it. Yeah. So... does that answer your question? What was the question?
It does. I mean, like, another way of asking the question is, the feminist critique of having more children is that male earnings don't go down at all. Yep. And yours would have, because you took a period of part-time work, which is quite unusual. Most dads don't do that.
Yeah. But I guess we don't do the calculation between like a female earner and a male earner, because we're a unit, right? Yep. So we're just, you know, we're happily married. So we just do all the calculations as a lump sum.
Yeah.
So it's not it doesn't obviously gender is key to this conversation, but as a unit bringing up a family, we're just looking at the final amount. So we say, so we're just saying, like, can we survive on, you know, a full-time salary plus a smattering of contract work or something like that, you know, what's that total amount? And then we're like, yep, we can do it. So I think Kaz is definitely conscious that she wants to keep her profession going, and we've essentially said that the aim of the game for her is just keep going. You know, it doesn't even matter if it's like, you know, half an hour a week or something like that. Just don't tick the box, which is like, I am now full-time mum and I'm putting my career to the side. Like, yeah. She is, and I think she's doing a fantastic job where she's like, she is definitely still considers herself as an architect. Yeah. And she is, you know, that's what she does and that's her profession. I mean, like, she, just before we had the third, Hutton, she registered as an architect. So she's gung-ho about it. So I think, yeah, we're seeing it as a blip in the road. And so that's the financial perspective. And then we did the, you know, the care perspective, that kind of thing. And, you know, we've got friends that are, you know, somewhere between 0 to 3 kids, with varying perceptions on, like, you know, how this affects our lives. And, you know, like, essentially we've just given up. we're parents. Yeah. Like that's our number one label.
Yeah. Yeah.
it's impossible to you know, have much more on your plate than that. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things that when you first raised this idea of just add one more, I immediately noticed a similarity in the way in corporate culture or in fitness culture, we keep talking about mental blocks being what stops you from achieving A, B, or C.
Mm.
You see this all the time in fitness culture. That is like the whole of David Goggins's like business platform,
what an insane person.
I love that dude because he is hilarious. I almost want to do a segment called Calm Down David because he just does these videos where he'll just be like...
Like I always say, this message isn't for everybody. Some of you are so weak. Just being in your very presence can make a man go impotent.
All right, man, that seems to be a little bit confusing. But that guy is just absolutely insane. But his... You know, the sort of family of personal motivators, you could even argue that sometimes Huberman drifts into this sort of territory of you can just stop putting mental limitations on yourself. And but you talk to parents about how many kids they're going to have and it's doctrinal that they are having two and no more than two.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
And then 5 minutes later they'll talk about how much endless love they experience from having children.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I just like, I think it's Seth Rogen, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's just got this great little bit in his special.
We got two now. We're a little more loose with it. You know, we realize now we don't like hanging out with friends that just have one toddler. They're too stressed out. We also don't like hanging out with friends that also have two. There's just too much going on. We like hanging out with people who have three or more kids. Because people with three or more kids are so zen and checked out. They are so checked out. There could not be a sound loud enough from the other room that will make them put down their CBD-infused Pinot Grigio. Crashing down, and they're like watching in there, guys. They're kids, they're fine, they're kids. Somebody runs in and is like, a raccoon bit me, and they're like, did you bite him back? They're kids, they gotta learn, they're kids.
Myers. Yeah. Yes. Yep. Seth Myers. Yes. So I am David Gogginsing my child number.
Yep.
Yeah, my parenting. I'm just like, yes, I have got no barriers. Yes, 4, 5, 6.
So
give me a number.
You've pushed through the impossible. You've pushed through two and gotten to three. How are you going?
I'm going good. Mm-hmm. You should ask Kaz.
Yeah, how's she going? Just destroyed from sleep deprivation.
Absolutely destroyed. I'm personally going well. Yeah. I think Kaz is bearing the brunt at the moment, but that's, you know, we know this. It's just, you know, when you've got a newborn, it's just 100% mum.
Yeah.
So, you know, so she's at home a lot. She's doing a lot more care while, you know, I'm drinking beers with you, doing a podcast together. But
when she's busy with the baby, there are two other kids to take care of.
Yeah.
And they fall straight to dad.
Exactly. Yeah. No, to be serious, it's going well. Yeah. You're definitely going into a third with a lot of practice. Mm. So a lot of those silly things that you did with the newborn, with your first kid, you're just not doing with your third. So, you know, like I keep teasing, but essentially anybody that has one kid,
yeah,
you know, you notice that people with one kid both of the parents will do something together with the for the kid. So yep. like, for example, like changing a nappy or like going to the bathroom yep. or like, you know, going to the, you know, the first doctor visit or something like that. And there's two parents there. That is absolutely insane.
Oh my God, yes.
It's like, yeah. And you learn that pretty quickly. Like all you have to do is have a second one. You know, and then you realize
we haven't learned that with the daycare drop off. This is the like the number of like I actually had one dad tell us the other day, like, what are both of you doing here? And I'm like, I know, right? Like, exactly. This is such a waste of resources.
Yeah. Yeah. So you become extremely efficient. You know, you realize that there are essential things to do, you know, feed them, wash them, make sure that they're happy, make sure that they're warm, you know. Make sure that they're safe. And, you know, back to the one of the themes of this conversation, this, you know, selfish reason to have more kids, you realize that, you know, kids are pretty resilient, you know, and especially if they've got siblings, they have got somebody to hit, essentially, you know. Yeah, which, you know, being in an argument and a fight is better than boredom. so we've really sort of taken the, you know, taken the pedal off, the accelerator off, and where we've realized that, you know, there's lots of things that we don't need to do. Like, this is going to sound insane, but we realize that you don't need to wash kids that much.
No.
You know. And this came because we renovated our house. And we didn't have a shower for 6 months and we didn't have a toilet for 6 months.
Good God.
So, yeah. So we had a portaloo out the front of the house. So it was just, you know, it was like a war zone.
Unbelievable.
And the kids showered once a week if they were lucky, you know, and we've just kept that habit. They have one shower a week and you just give the sniff test. Yeah.
Do you remember Ashton Kutcher and Mila Kunis cop some shit for doing something like that?
Mm.
They were on some sort of, I can't remember what the situation, but word got out that they didn't bath their kids very often.
Yeah.
And they copped a lot of shit for it. And I remember thinking at the time that I don't have a problem with it, but I'm just like, you're so rich. What else are you doing with your time?
Exactly.
Like, yeah, but you don't bath them, but surely they must all have their own pool at some stage.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Yeah. Oh, there's another book that I read in the same vein, sort of parenting book. Have you heard of it? Let Them Eat Dirt?
No.
I swear I would have given you this rant as well.
No, haven't heard it.
Yeah. It's in the same vein as, you know, selfish reasons to have more kids. But Let Them Eat Dirt is just about how over-sanitized we are to our children in particular, it's really about, like, you know, our contemporary society at the moment, America, Australia, is obsessed with cleanliness, and it's just, it's really not necessary. And there's the whole flip side about, like, you know, healthy dirty and, like, actual dirty, you know. There's sort of, like, you know, uranium bad. And then there's, like, you know, just dirt, you know, and dirt is actually a positive to children. Like, we know this, right?
Mm.
But we don't act it out.
Mm.
You know, we're still, like, you know, wiping down every surface in our house and blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, after that book, we completely got rid of all bleach, all, you know, sort of alcohol-based cleaning products and things like that. And we just use, you know, like, lemon vinegar and sort of natural cleaning products like that. You know, we don't really use that much, you know, shampoo and things like that. Yeah, it's, we've really toned down on the cleaning.
I remember early in the podcast days, like, once you have kids, start becoming a lot more sensitive to messages in the media and advertising that are meant for mothers.
Mm.
So I remember I needed to get a fabric softener, and the catchphrase of the fabric softener was, soft as a mother's touch. And I'm standing there buying the fucking thing. And I'm just like, a dad's made of sandpaper or something. Like, yeah, this is absurd. And I've been like, I reached out to the company and I was just like, look, I'm not offended by this, but I'm just like, this is really stupid.
Yeah.
You've got to understand that there's a new generation of dads coming through that are buying this stuff. And this messaging we just find really dumb. And if one of your competitors figures this out,
yeah,
we're going to buy like, you know, Ford Ute fabric softener or something. Like, I don't know what they're going to come up with.
It was probably that HR lady that you used to work with. She came up with
it. Yes. Yeah. Like, have a sense of humor, guys. Fabric softener.
I'm just old fashioned.
I'm just, guys will get their turn. But yeah, that's something that I don't see a lot of change. I can see some change happening at the margins at the way that family products that have been marketed exclusively to mums are slowly starting to include dads.
Yeah.
And I'll be fascinated to see how that plays out.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. The go-to is always, you know, the kids' favorite TV show, right? Mm. Like, you know, you just put gender aside and you put Bluey on anything and it just sells like hotcakes. It's like, it's the easiest thing for advertisers. It's just like, you know, like you don't, that's the old adage. It's like, you know, you don't like mum and dad don't decide on the things that are bought for the family. The kid does, you know? And it's like, I can't, like so many times we've been at the supermarket and I've gone to buy milk and then there's the little Bluey UHT ones. Have you seen that?
I haven't. No, I haven't.
It's not in the milk section. Yeah. It's in like the UHT cereal section.
Yeah.
And my eldest knows that there's Bluey milks. So I'll pick up the 2 liter and she goes, nah, we're getting the Bluey milks.
It's like there's a lock on the other products. Yeah. I can't lift them into my goddamn trolley. We're having some beers to celebrate the end of Parch March.
We are.
You said to me at one stage that alcohol in no way makes you a better parent.
And oh, God, no.
And I think I agree with you. Mm. Do you want to just tell me the story about how you came to that realization?
There wasn't any particular situation.
No. I'm thinking more it would have occurred to you over time. Do you want to just sort of tell that story?
What can I say? I think it was just a progressive series of realizing that I've snapped at my kid for no reason. You know, and it's well into the second day of hangover and you know, I've caught myself shouting at them and it's like, why am I shouting?
Yeah.
This is ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Yeah. So that's one thing. And yeah, realizing that you don't have enough energy and you're saying no to them a lot more. Yeah. This is all, yeah, it's all the day after. So yeah, it's so obvious that it doesn't make you a better parent.
Yeah.
From an energy level, from a perspective, you know, outward perspective level, from a, you know, outwardly loving perspective. Yeah. It's not, yeah. I'm not my best.
Yeah.
The day after. That's for sure.
I'm really excited to get into this because I have probably dropped about $80 on a bottle of whiskey every 2 weeks for probably the last 5 or 6 years.
Yep.
So that's 20 standard drinks per bottle, 10 standard drinks per week,
yep,
basically, without even thinking about it.
Yep.
And I would tend to consume these, like, it's so easy to rationalize it because you're just like, oh, it's just two a night on a weeknight. It's just like you're drinking on a weeknight.
Yeah.
But it would be the, you know, it would be the excuse of I have had a stressful day. This is how I unwind.
Mm.
And deep down, I knew that there was an anxiety that I felt that was more or less constant.
Mm.
That was, I think intuitively I knew that it was in some way related to alcohol.
Mm.
And then you know, there's this emerging research that, in fact, I don't even know it's emerging. I've just started to come across it, where it talks about how alcohol is used as a way to quell your anxiety when you are stressed, but then your threshold for feeling anxious goes down because that's what alcohol effectively does. It lowers your tolerance for anxiety. And so this kind of built up and up and up over a while, and I knew I had to give myself a break from brews. And you and I had talked about it a couple of times because I realized I have not gone more than 10 days without a drink since 2005.
Yeah.
And that was because we were in Iran, which is a dry country. So I don't think that really counts.
Yeah.
And then we had a break like last year.
Yeah. What was the month?
It was mid-month to mid-month because it was after a wedding and I knew that I was going to be.
And was the start of the year? Was it March last year?
It was about mid-March to mid-April.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was that your first month without booze?
No, it wasn't. Yeah, but it was my first. It was my first designated Parch March. You know, month off.
Yeah.
And I was really into it because I know how much groupthink and like having somebody to do a challenge with.
Yeah.
Makes an impact to your success rate, you know. It just like
it's a training partner.
Yeah, it just quadruples it, you know. So as soon as you were like, yeah, I think I need to do it, and I think you were sort of tiptoeing around the idea. You were like, yeah, maybe I do it, and I'm like, yeah, let's just do it, you know. And then it was locked in. Yeah. Then it was relatively easy to do. So yeah, it was the first time I'd conscientiously not drunk. Yep. For a month. But I not out of any big reason. I think probably Kaz, my wife, is an influence. We just don't really have alcohol around the house. Yep. So it's not you know, we'll buy something for special occasions, but I've definitely gone drinking without a month without consciously doing it. Yeah. But that's not really the biggest worry for me. For me, it's the association with your stress or anxiety or something going wrong with your life, and then turning to booze.
Yeah.
When that occurs, and I've definitely been in that situation before, you know, and I think doing a month with you is a good time to recollect about, you know, when am I triggered to start drinking,
yeah.
You know, and you give yourself sort of space about that. And I hadn't really done that until we did the month together, you know, and it's, yeah, and going like, oh, yeah. Oh, okay. So now I'm conscientiously not drinking alcohol. When am I unconsciously, you know, or you know, when am I not thinking and I'll just grab for the beers.
Yeah.
You know, and it's definitely stress related.
Yeah.
So
did you notice any difference between the 2 months? Did you notice that one of them was easier or harder than the last one, or one had a larger impact on your behavior afterwards?
So you're talking about the one that we did last year and the one that we just did?
Yeah.
Well, I told you, right?
Oh, what'd you tell me again?
I broke.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, well.
I broke.
Yeah, at a wedding, which is really unfortunate.
I fucked up.
Yeah. I've just spilled beer down my front.
Oh, you're a disaster. I broke 20 days in. I had a couple of drinks at a wedding. So
weddings are hard.
Yeah. I wasn't successful.
Nah.
So yeah, which is you know, which is another dimension that I think we're gonna talk about, which is, you know, the social aspect or the, you know, being in a social environment and wanting to drink. So, you know, it's like being at a wedding is extremely difficult.
Oh my God.
You know, it's...
Was it an entertaining start of the wedding? Because if it's not, and you get to the reception, you're just like, get me a fucking drink.
Yeah. It was the vodka martinis on tap that did it.
Outrageous.
Not a physical tap, but, you know, like it was free pour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, God. No, that's really hard. But putting that aside...
Did I notice a difference?
Yeah.
Between the 2 months? Well, I think this time was actually a lot harder.
Right.
Because I was a lot more conscientious about it and then I broke.
Mm.
So, yeah, and then I felt bad.
But you've also got... a young kid at home, so more stress.
Potentially. Mm. Yeah, potentially. Yeah, that could have factored in.
Mm.
Yeah, because, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I definitely found the first one harder, but that's because I was getting shit-faced for the 4 days leading up to it and then just went cold turkey and just like, wow, this is terrible.
Yeah.
And I also noticed that, you know, I went straight back into my habit of buying a bottle of liquor probably about once every 2 weeks.
Yep. Okay.
More or less straight back into the habit.
Yep.
You know, maybe a few weeks.
Yep.
But this time, you know, learned my lesson from the last time. So I didn't drink for about 10 days heading into Parch March.
Okay.
Because I just thought probably better to just taper off a bit because then the adjustment won't be as hard. And I found, but I also found Parch March to be a lot easier.
There you go.
And a couple of factors, a couple of takeaways. There's no more brown liquor in the house.
Mm.
I did notice that I don't give it, like, so there's gin, you know, vermouths, some vodka.
Yeah.
I think we had some wines in the house for a period of time, a few beers. None of that tempted me at all.
Mm.
Didn't care. But brown liquor is my weak point.
Yeah.
And so I've just very consciously not purchased any brown liquor since then.
Yeah.
And I think this is my, what are we, April 11th. I think this is my third and fourth drink since the end of March.
Yeah.
And so that's pretty illuminating. I've also noticed that, hey, I'm not spending this money on brown liquor. I bought Rachel a necklace because I'd just never been flush with cash this much with personal spending money. So I was just like, it probably helpful for being a better human being.
That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah. We've got nice bottles of wine and stuff and that we got as presents and things like that. And we don't touch those, but that's interesting that brown liquor is the key. So if you had a six pack in the fridge, you just wouldn't really pick it up.
Don't really care. And there was like, I went out to a pub, I think twice, either in a group situation or one-on-one with another person and did not mind, although it was very helpful to have some zero alcohol beers there.
Yep.
Like I definitely had them both times just to quell the I'm missing out.
Yeah, totally.
Sense.
Yeah.
But it didn't really matter.
Yeah.
Just to come back to something that you referenced, so much of the pressure to drink comes from social pressure. We obviously move in the same social circles. Do you feel a bit of a shift in the sort of groups that you move in, which lowers the pressure to drink? Like there's just less drinking going on and more people that you can just choose not to drink with.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah. But that's that. Yeah, definitely. In the groups that we're part of, drinking has reduced a lot. But it's also a society-wide thing, you know, like Gen Z is not drinking, you know, whatever the ones are below that. Now alphas are probably not going to drink that much.
Mm.
And millennials, us, we drink dramatically less than the boomers, you know. So I think I wouldn't be surprised if the general trend is that everybody is drinking less for whatever this weird cultural thing is that's happening. And that'll percolate, you know, through friendship groups, through the office, you know, through, you know, your home situation, things like that. So I think, you know, all you have to do is look at zero alcohol beer and how that has just like absolutely exploded
fastest
over the past
growing drinking category there is.
It's absolutely insane. Yeah. So, you know, it's like an absolutely positive cultural change. Mm. I don't have the theory behind it, why it's happening. My only theory is that people are taking more drugs. But
well, yeah. I did talk about that.
Yeah. But it's an amazingly positive thing. I think it's a positive thing for our friendship group. You know, I do not bemoan the fact that we're drinking less.
Mm.
You know, I do like to go to the pub with everybody still, you know, but, you know, I'm happy for those to be fewer and more isolated and more special.
Yeah.
You know, really, you know, we're going to go to Daddy Bar, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Daddy Bar in where we live in Brunswick.
Just off Blythe Street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, local gay bar.
Yeah.
Daddy Bar.
It's in the title.
Exactly. Yeah. We're going to do our dad-themed podcast. Then we're going to go to the daddy-themed bar.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But, yeah, no, I think it's great. Yeah. And, you know, I think from down to the smallest unit, like the home life perspective, it's only positive that we've got less alcohol in the house, you know? So yeah, I would, I'll propose you a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Rachel will accept. I think I proposed this challenge to you in the first Parch March.
Yeah.
Which is get every drop of alcohol out of the house.
Oh, right. Okay.
For a month. Yeah.
Would Rachel agree to that?
I don't think she would.
I think she'd probably, what she'd do, she'd agree to it and then she would approach you privately and say, I am hiding it in the house. So Alex thinks that it's out of the house.
Yeah.
And that's all we really need to do on that.
Yeah, which is fine as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. We can just lie to you.
Yeah.
It'll still work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I noticed another thing this month. I can't really remember last month, last time I did it, but this month I noticed two things. One, exercise level went up. Obviously, you've got a kid under the age of like 3 months, so, you know, it's a shit show. But my exercise went up and my reading went up as well.
Yeah, awesome.
And I just, TV became less attractive because it just, you know, my brain's just clearer.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. That's great. Yeah. I had huge changes as well. I lost 7 kilos.
Shit.
Yeah. Yeah. I was dieting at the same time.
Yeah.
But it's the same thing. It's
7 kilos.
Yeah. It's like, oh, I've actually got time to think about other things, you know? So you were thinking about reading and blah, 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 you know, buying necklaces and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, I've got time to actually, you know, look at what I'm making myself for dinner, you know? So it was just like plummeted. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. I've put it all back on though.
Well, my other challenge is, and I did find that giving up drinking, so this is another story. So probably about 4 years ago, I went for a check. Yeah, because it was after Hazel was born. I went for a checkup with the doctor because it was just this like, okay, you've had a kid, you're a bit stressed, probably good to just do a general all-around checkup. So the doctor got some blood work and she's like, cholesterol's a bit high.
Mm.
Like it's got I think it was a 7 or 8 in front of it. You're supposed to have nothing higher than like a 4.8.
Okay.
So not good. And she was very keen to put me on statins. Then we moved house. And I went to see another doctor and he does much more of a, let's just try to fix this with diet and exercise, blah, blah, blah. So I got a reading with him and it was down to 6.6 and he's like, still a bit high, but let's keep going at this.
Yeah.
And then Beatrix was born and like my chocolate consumption was just through the roof and my drinking was out of control. And I'm just like, I can't reasonably do a test with this guy yet because I'm not going to respect the result.
Yeah.
So I got a test during Parch March.
Yeah.
And this is at the end of about sort of 6 months of slowly building myself up. I'm in a bit of a fitness kick at the moment. So I'm going to respect this number.
Yeah.
And it was 6.4.
Okay.
I'm like, oh, fuck. That's not come down enough.
So what are you doing? You're eating a lot of meat, eggs or something?
So the doc was basically saying, try to cut out. So like one of the things that I was doing in the morning was increasing my fiber intake, which is like eating, you know, that all bran, which is basically cardboard.
Yeah.
But the problem that I was doing is I was eating it with Greek yogurt, which is not normal yogurt. That is yogurt with fat like added to it.
Yeah.
So apparently, it's delicious. But it looks healthy.
Yeah.
And it kind of feels that you're just like, it looks probably fine. But he's just like, no, Greek yogurt is not actually good for your cholesterol levels. And quite clearly, I am predisposed to having elevated levels of cholesterol.
Yeah.
Because my diet is not nuts. Like, we don't consume an insane amount of red meat in our house.
Okay.
We don't consume an insane amount of cheese. My partner's cholesterol level is not an issue.
So it's you. Yeah.
I'm just lost that genetic lottery.
Yeah.
But again, doc's just like, you know, I'm not putting on statins yet. And I was reading this book saying that that is a confusing perspective. Because the medical industry basically says, unless you have an elevated chance of dying in the next 10 years, we don't put you on statins because the potential negative consequences outweigh the benefits.
Yeah.
But the negative consequences are like achy joints, which you can deal with by just going on a different type of statin because there are about 7 of them. And so there was one book that I was reading by a longevity expert, doctor by the name of Peter Attia. Who said, I'll put people on statins very early and without hesitation, and I think it's a much better solution. But then another mate of mine, Kim, reached out and said that there are some natural products that you can take that effectively compete with cholesterol in your bloodstream for space in your arteries.
Right. And
this stuff doesn't get jammed.
Yeah.
So I might go down that line in some sense, man. But
it sounds like such a rabbit hole. And it's like, I listen to, well, I don't anymore, you know, Paul Saladino, carnivore dude.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, he loves meat.
Yeah.
And he just completely rejects the idea that cholesterol's an issue.
Yeah.
He's just like, he gloats about it.
Yeah.
He's like his cholesterol levels are 10 or something like that. And then he's like flexing his abs and stuff. And he's like, yeah see, I'm the best. Look at my 10.
See, my dad listens. So for the audience, my dad's a nutritionist.
He'd be straight into this.
His cholesterol level is 8 and he's proud about it. Yeah, and I'm just like, yeah, dad, my maternal grandfather, which is not your dad, it's your wife's dad, was dead at 61 from a heart attack. And so that's a bit of a stop sign for me that I'm a little bit more conscious of. Like, it's genuinely confusing. Like, a lot of the time when I get to a point where I'm like, I'm not really sure what I think about this, I just go to The Conversation, an Australian media company that's international, which a friend of mine used to edit. You know, so I just Google something, a subject that I want to know something about, go to The Conversation, and they generally have a pretty even-handed, if slightly conservative, take on it.
Yeah.
And they had two, like, heart health experts from leading universities going, we don't really know.
Right.
Like, cholesterol is very confusing. And I was just like, not helpful.
Yeah.
Really not helpful.
Just tell me.
Just fucking tell me what I can eat.
Well, this is... Yeah, it's tricky. It's like if you focus on one metric and that metric is the panacea or it's the problem, the ultimate problem, you're always going to have issues that come out of that. So, you know, it's like, you know, from another conversation that is going on at the moment, it's like being fat, right? You know, or having extra weight on you. You know, it's like, you know, some people say that it is that somebody that is high on the BMI can be, you know, by all metrics, infinitely more healthy than somebody that is low on the BMI, you know? So it's like you cannot just focus on weight being the metric of health. And it's like you can just take anything like that, you know, statins or, you know, cholesterol or, you know, low blah blah blah, you know. So yeah, I'm conscientious of our, because I do the same thing. Like I grab onto something and I go, oh, it's my iron levels, you know? Yeah. Or, you know, I was obsessed. You know, I'm obsessed with feet, right?
Yes.
With my shoes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm like, it's the shoes. It's my feet. That's the problem.
If yeah, you just walk around in a leather jacket, except it's shoes.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm just like, if only I fixed my feet, everything would be correct. Yeah. So, yeah, I find, yeah, just looking at cholesterol levels or, you know, or blood pressure or something like that, it's like, it's important, but yeah, we've got to look at the whole person.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Have you done a full body review thing, you know, like whatever they call it, the full body scan?
I've never done a full body scan, partly because it's never been suggested to me and partly because there was a Scrubs episode on it where they say, like, if you get a full body scan, you're probably going to highlight three issues that are not issues and they'll just give you a massive anxiety attack.
Yeah, yeah,
have you
yeah,
ever
yeah.
done one of these things?
I have. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So when I was working in China, it was free.
Oh,
it was
wow.
part of my employment. So I got everything done.
Wow.
Yeah.
What'd you learn?
I was overweight.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
That's it. But that's pretty good. That was like the only thing that they had. So I got full blood panel thing, you know, got all that done. Yeah. You know, got the finger, you know, up the bum.
Oh, I've had a few of those. Like, I should give context. Yeah, I'll tell this story. How much of the story do I'm going to tell?
So there was I got a finger up the bum.
Yeah. So I remember one time I was with my ex-girlfriend's now husband, who's a doctor. And I can't remember how we drifted into this conversation, but I said that I had had a finger up my ass 4 times from doctors. And he was just like, that's a lot for your age. And so I gave him some context and I was just like, look, there was one time recently where I, where he was testing for, I was getting this in, like, this was before, hang on. This was before Hazel was born. Just before Hazel was born, I went up for a weekend in Mount Hotham and I looked down in the toilet bowl and there was blood in there. And I'm just like, that is a bad sign. So I went to the doctor and I told the doctor, I was just like, look, there were 2 times where I got a finger in my ass to check for hemorrhoids.
Mm.
And, but I was concerned, like I'd never actually seen blood in my stool. So I was just like, look, I'm concerned that this is something else. So those are the two fingers. And then the doctor said, you've actually got, that was the third finger to go into me. And he's just like, you've got.
Not at the same time, right?
Not at the same time. Doctor didn't put on like a glove that only had one hole in it just for his fist.
I think this one needs 5 fingers.
Anyway, so he stuck the third finger that had been, finger number 3. And he said, you've actually got an anal fissure. You've got a broken asshole.
Yeah.
Which Ooh. Did make me wonder, like, that's just like, can an anal fissure like just keep going?
Ugh.
Like if I strain hard enough, can I just rip myself in half? So anyway, so that cleared that up. But the fourth happened when I was very, very young. And this is where the ex-partner's husband comes in. And I told this story about how one time I was getting like this intense stomach pain, like lying on the floor in my parents' home when I was about 8 years old. And dad takes me to the doctor and he's just like, well, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this. Look, it's an outside chance, but I can rule something out if I stick a finger up his bum. And dad's just like seeing me in absolute agony and he's just like, whatever you need to do, doc. So that happens. It's the first finger in my ass was like when I was 8 years old. And so I'm telling this story and everyone's kind of reacting the way that you're reacting. Just like, ah, isn't this funny? And the look on my ex's partner's face is just getting graver and graver and graver. And I'm just like, I was telling this story for you. Why are you not laughing? And he's just like, there is no medical reason for him to do that. I'm like, what the fuck happened to me?
Oh, no. That's ridiculous.
Anyway, so I don't know if I was raped. Yeah. And I'm not sure I have any feelings on the subject. I just find the whole story really funny.
There could have been a medical reason.
It's like one of those, there's another Scrubs episode where there's this, they get Dick Van Dyke to go, let's do a cut down on this patient, which is a procedure that hasn't been done since like the 30s or something. And, you know, the whole episode is just like, this guy needs to have his medical license taken away from him. So I might have run into that guy.
That's hilarious. Anyway. When I got the finger done, it was the doctor didn't speak English. So it was this old Chinese dude, you know. I just had like, you know, doing this full blood panel and everything, it was just like normal aged people.
Yeah.
And then they'd clearly, you know, gone like, oh, he's the finger up the bum dude and he's been doing it for 50 years. He's really good at it. Just let him, that's his specialty. So I walk into the room and there's this old guy and, you know, for the listeners at home, he doesn't say anything. He just looks at me dead in the eye and just lifts his index finger up and just goes, yep, we're going to do this thing? And I'm like, yeah, okay, bent over. Yeah, but supposedly you don't have to get a finger up the bum anymore. You can just do it with blood samples and stuff, right?
You can now do it, I think, with blood samples and stool samples. Yeah. You don't have to do it,
yeah,
which
yeah.
is good because I still have a broken asshole. So the treatment is this cream that they give you called Rectalcil. And I've worked in a pharmacy before. People who work in pharmacies know exactly what that person has. And so like every time they hand out Rectalcil, they know, this guy's got a broken asshole.
Oh, no.
And I tried, it's 2 weeks you've got to put this cream on, but the ingredient, I shit you not, is the active ingredient in dynamite. Like it's, hang on, I'm going to look this up. What's the fucking, Rectalcil, is that it? Yep. No, that's an insulation company. anyway, like the active ingredient in dynamite, like which is, you know, an explosive, is, you know, it's only like 0.25% of this cream.
Yeah, that's what you want in your ass.
But you put it, you put it on, and it, like, you get headaches for like the whole 2 week period. It's fucked.
Mm.
So I did it for like a week. And then genuinely, Hazel was like within a month of being born. And I'm just like, I'm not wasting one of my last weeks of freedom having headaches with this fucking flaming asshole. Fine. So I've never revisited it. And
what's it meant to do? Like heal it?
So the point is it's supposed to relax it to the point where like over the course of 2 weeks, the problem is that when you shit, it expands. And when you, like when you're not shitting, it tightens up.
Mm.
And the idea is that it's supposed to relax it, but not so much that you shit yourself.
Shit everywhere. Yeah.
They're supposed to relax it enough over that period so that it heals over the course of 2 weeks, but it's fucked.
Oh my God.
I've still got the tube sitting at home. Wondering when I'm going to get 2 weeks spare.
Yeah. Next time we have a party at your place, we'll just get the rectal set up.
And yeah. I think that is the perfect note to end on. Alex, thank you very much for joining over.
Cheers,
my
mate.
Dead body.
That was my chat with father of three and brother from another mother, but with the same name, Alex Breeden. Just another kid. Just have another kid. Just do it. Do it. Just have another one. I love the simplicity. In terms of booze reflections, I absolutely agree with Alex that alcohol just doesn't make you a better parent in any way. And I have definitely had those instances where I'm yelling at my kid for no reason. And you just can't rule out alcohol as a structural factor for those sort of moments. So trying to rule it out. Or at least reduce it. Still no brown liquor in the house over here. I'm really happy about that. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back shortly with more episodes. For now, though, my name's Alex Lidington Cox. Have a good one.